ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 6th of August. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Israel's Prime Minister is reportedly demanding his country's military back his idea for a total occupation of Gaza in what would be a dramatic escalation in the 22-month-long war. Benjamin Netanyahu is facing pressure to find a resolution in Gaza. He's losing public support and dealing with sustained and increasing international criticism over the humanitarian crisis in the Strip. Middle East correspondent Matthew Dorant reports.
On a dusty road in Khan Yunis, southern Gaza, a crowd swarms a convoy of aid trucks carrying desperately needed food. Among the starving Palestinians is Yusuf Abu Moor, originally from Rafah, an area now off limits to Gazans and under full Israeli control.
I want a bag of flour for my children. I should not be forced to walk for 7 kilometres. It has been 2.5 weeks that I come and I don't get anything, really nothing. Every 2 hours, there are two trucks. These two trucks won't be enough for all these people that you see.
Israel continues to exercise significant control over the entry of aid into the Strip, despite easing restrictions a week and a half ago.
It would be a mistake to relax or to be full of praise or even hope for this drip, drip, drip of humanitarian aid, because we've been here before.
James Elder is UNICEF's global spokesperson.
There's such an immense amount of deprivation, and then some aid comes in and there is a sense from through the world's press that things are improving and that therefore people take their eyes off again. But of course, everyone here knows that it was a limit of 500 trucks a day. That really now needs to be probably twice that amount.
Even as the details of the starvation crisis on the ground in Gaza are shared around the world, the Israeli Prime Minister continues to deny starvation exists in the Strip, a claim at odds with evidence on the ground and more deaths from severe hunger. Benjamin Netanyahu is reportedly pushing ahead with plans to expand his country's military campaign even further. The Israel Defense Forces already controls large swathes of Gaza, areas taken since the last ceasefire was shattered back in March. But multiple Israeli media outlets are reporting Benjamin Netanyahu is leaning towards total occupation of the Strip, something which hasn't been Israeli policy for 20 years since the IDF withdrew from Gaza in 2005. In a visit to a military base in central Israel, Mr. Netanyahu made his case to new recruits.
It's still necessary to complete the defeat of the enemy in Gaza, to release all our hostages, to ensure that Gaza will no longer pose a threat to Israel. We're not giving up on any of these tasks.
The fact this is being considered by the Prime Minister gives an insight into his mindset. Refusing to compromise in Gaza, even as many argue now is the time to strike a ceasefire and hostage deal with Hamas, while ignoring the fears of hostage families that their loved ones will be collateral in his war. 50 are still held in Gaza, 20 are believed to be alive. This is Matthew Doran in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
Palestinian Australians say their community here is struggling with what's happening in Gaza, and they're asking the rest of us to be understanding about the emotional toll some are enduring. A Brisbane principal who's lost more than 130 members of his family in Gaza is among them. He's reluctantly stood aside from his job and is warning of deteriorating mental health. National Education reporter Connor Duffy has the story.
As he strums a mournful tune on his lute, Principal Sami Muammar is trying to escape survivor's guilt and recurring images of his family in Gaza begging for help.
I am standing up in a step, and under me is a lot of hellfire. And I've seen a lot of people putting their hands up and pick me up, pick me up.
Sami Muammar left Gaza in 2002. His comfortable suburban Gold Coast home is no longer a refuge. Technology brings constant news of death and hunger. Sami Muammar says he stopped counting when the number of family members killed reached 130. He provided a list of 112 names. AM was able to verify 103 of them using a database of war dead from the Gaza Ministry of Health. Sami Muammar fears the list will continue to grow.
When I look at the group chat, I'm thinking of my sisters, and I can show you her photos. I talked to her the other day. She's skin and a bone from hunger. There's no food. Well, I told her, what do you eat? And she started crying.
The constant stress and worry has meant Sami Muammar has had to step down as principal of Islamic College of Brisbane, a busy private school.
The school means a lot to me. The school is my community, my friends, my colleagues. The students are like my kids, really. I love them so much.
The school's CEO, Ali Kadri, who is also a leader in the Islamic community, supports the decision but warns others are suffering too.
The challenges are immense. I mean, people think that this is happening far away, but it's not really happening far away. It's happening on our mobile screens, it's happening on our TV screens, and it's human beings suffering.
Dr. Mohammed Mustafa is one of the few Australians who's visited Gaza since the war. The trainee doctor describes brutal scenes.
Children are coming in dismembered. We don't even have proper sutures, painkillers. You know, it's like being a butcher. It's not being a doctor, it's being a butcher.
Dr. Mustafa says the wider community is struggling and needs empathy.
Do you know, there's so many emotions. They're watching either, you know, the destruction of Gaza and what's happening there. They're watching family members being killed. It makes it very, very hard to be a Palestinian.
Back on the Gold Coast, Sami Muammar is retreating to his garden and hopes the time away will lead to new growth.
When you plant a seed and you see it coming back, it gives you hope of life. When I've seen that Gaza is really destructed, I have hope. It's like planting a seed and make a new generation come. It makes you that there is hope for coexistence.
School principal Sami Muammar emitting that report from Connor Duffy. If you've had a trip to Canberra or you live there, you'd be familiar with the dress circle of embassies surrounding Parliament House. Some of them are huge and impressive, like the British, Canadian and Chinese diplomatic missions. Russia wanted part of that action too, and it had a lease over a site with plans to build, but Australia cancelled it, citing national security reasons. That will have a sequel in the High Court today as Russia tries to persuade judges that cancelling the lease was illegal. Elizabeth Byrne reports.
It's no surprise the relationship between Australia and Russia is strained, triggered by events including the war in Ukraine and the downing of MH17. But it's the cancellation of its lease for a new embassy that has driven Russia to the courts. International law professor Don Rothball says Russia is making a point.
Russia probably sees this as a matter of principle, that they are a significant world power, that they are a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council. They're a country that's had long-standing diplomatic relations with Australia, and they probably see it as really being quite a diplomatic affront.
Russia got the lease in 2008, but when no embassy materialised, it was cancelled, leading to a sticky legal and diplomatic situation, especially when Russia won a federal court challenge. In 2023, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese announced a new law rescinding the lease, citing national security.
The government has received very clear security advice as to the risk presented by a new Russian presence so close to Parliament House.
Russia will challenge that notion today, pointing to the other nearby embassies, saying national security interests aren't engaged just because the land is near Parliament. Don Rothwell says it's not surprising the close proximity is a concern.
The way in which technology has emerged and the way in which embassies can eavesdrop on various activities of government, including Parliament House, has clearly enhanced in recent years.
Russia will tell the High Court the Constitution doesn't give the Parliament the power to make a law taking away its lease. But if it loses that argument, Russia says it should be compensated on just terms. The Commonwealth will tell the High Court just terms does not extend to compensating a foreign state for actions designed to protect Australia's democratic institutions. Don Rothwell says the key question is whether the termination is actually an acquisition of property, and that may be the real point of Russia's case.
And ultimately, a good outcome for Russia could be that the Commonwealth is ordered to pay them a certain compensation with respect to the question of the acquisition of this property.
International law professor Don Rothwell ending that report by Elizabeth Byrne. Plastic was initially hailed as a terrific invention, but we now know that it's leaving a terrible legacy, from pollution to pollution in animals to nanoparticles being a danger to human health. 170 nations, including Australia, are in Geneva to discuss a new legally binding plastics treaty to limit its production, but major fossil fuel nations and plastic manufacturers are pushing back. Annie Guest reports.
The sound of a scientist examining a seabird full of plastic makes for uncomfortable listening. Also confronting is plastic's grave, growing and under-recognised danger to humans, as described by world experts in a Lancet study this week. A treaty to deal with plastics is back on the agenda at the United Nations. Environmental lawyer Eliza Northrup advises Pacific countries under the Global Ocean Accounts Partnership.
I am hoping that we walk away in sort of slightly less than 2 weeks with the first globally binding treaty to end plastic pollution.
And ideally, what would a globally binding treaty include?
So an obligation around phasing out the most problematic plastic products and chemicals of concern, improving the design of plastic products, and then right through to making sure that we limit leakages into our marine environment and really have a mechanism in place to start cleaning up existing and legacy plastics in our marine environment.
Many plastics manufacturers around the world are represented by the American Chemistry Council. Its president, Chris Jahn, is also in Geneva.
We think this negotiation should be focused on ending plastic pollution in the environment. There is consensus and alignment among all countries in the world about focusing on that. Reducing plastic production is not going to address that issue.
But if there's less plastic produced, how can that not help with pollution?
So, you know, the world is going to continue to grow and there's going to continue to be more people in the world, and we're going to need things like IV bags and seat belts and helmets that are vital to public health. We're going to continue to need all the benefits that plastics provide.
Environmentalists and others argue that single-use plastics that are not necessary, you know, like takeaway containers or straws, etc., should be banned. They're not suggesting not having IV bags, for instance.
Certainly. And so, you know, look, what we support is country-by-country approach.
Chris Jahn says plastic and chemical industries meaningfully contribute to the sound management of chemicals to help protect people and the environment. He questions the objectivity of the Lancet study's findings, saying scientists were funded by organisations that were supported by corporations that compete with plastics.
Annie Guest reporting. The British government says it'll start sending back illegal boat arrivals this week after ratifying a new migration scheme with the French government. But there are doubts the so-called one-in, one-out law will act as a deterrent for people smugglers and those willing to risk their lives to enter Britain. Europe correspondent Elias Kluwer reports from London.
On a beach in the south of Spain, tourists tackle a man to the ground. Spanish media reports that that man was an asylum seeker who'd been on a boat which landed on a popular tourist beach on Sunday. Vision on social media shows the inflatable dinghy landing on Sotillo Beach in Granada and several men then jumping off and swimming to safety. The images of desperate asylum seekers wading through water among chilled-out holidaymakers is a jarring one, but it shows the stark reality of an issue sweeping Europe.
The numbers reaching the UK to claim asylum, they've been over 100,000 for a couple of years. In France, it's closer to 150,000. Germany, even more than that. I think in 2024, 300,000. Also, other countries have it worse.
That's Peter Walsh, a senior researcher at the Oxford University Migration Observatory. He's been analysing migration trends in Europe.
They come from some of the most chaotic parts of the world. So Afghan, the most common nationality over the past couple of years. People are coming from Iran, from Syria, Eritrea, Yemen and Sudan, you know, places suffering under political persecution that have experienced regime change or are involved in active conflict.
In Britain, the issue has been dominating political discourse. Images of migrants boarding inflatable dinghies on the northern coast of France with hopes of crossing the English Channel saturate news bulletins. protests have been held outside hotels housing newly arrived asylum seekers, and Conservative politicians have pounced on the issue, with the populist Reform Party, led by Nigel Farage, seeing a boost in the polls. But Downing Street says it has the answer.
People who are arriving on small boats should, frankly, be returned to France. They're coming on illegal boats. They're paying thousands of pounds to criminal people smugglers. That money should be lost and they should be returned.
That's Yvette Cooper, the British Home Secretary, discussing the new British government pilot scheme, ratified with the French government, that will see boat arrivals who've crossed the English Channel illegally returned to France. The plan comes into effect this week.
They will be first detained until they are returned to France. And in exchange, we will take people who have applied lawfully, who have been through security checks.
Peter Walsh doesn't believe that'll act as a deterrent.
You have to bear in mind these are individuals who have paid thousands of euros to get to northern France. They've travelled thousands of miles. They're willing to risk their lives by getting in a small boat. A small chance of failure probably wouldn't be enough.
This is Elias Kluwer in London, reporting for AM.
Thousands of people will pause and remember today one of the most destructive and final moments of the Second World War. It marks 80 years since the United States dropped the first of two nuclear bombs on Japan. The first hit the city of Hiroshima. Our North Asia correspondent James Oden reports.
In the last moments of World War II, the United States President Harry S. Truman issued a final ultimatum to Japan.
Only surrender can prevent the kind of ruin which they have seen come to Germany as a result of continued useless resistance.
Japan wouldn't budge. So on August 6, 1945, the United States deployed the world's first nuclear attack.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima. It is an atomic bomb. The force from which the sun draws its power has been loosed against those who brought war to the Far East.
In a flash, tens of thousands of people were killed, much of the city centre in ruin. Kunihiko Ida was just three when the world around him went dark. The house he was in, just 900 metres from ground zero, collapsed.
I tried to call out to my mother, asking her to help me, but I couldn't make a sound. I had no idea where anyone was. No one was crying. No one was making a sound.
Miraculously, Kunihiko's grandfather was outside the house. He was able to dig the family out from under the rubble.
There were people whose clothes had burned away, their skin peeling off. If they tried to lower their arms, their skin would stick together. They gathered like ghosts. The next morning at dawn, almost everyone was dead.
Today, thousands of people will gather near Ground Zero, marking 80 years since the bomb. It wasn't just the fireball that killed. Radiation sickness also took hold. By the year's end, some 140,000 people were dead. Many who survived endured a lifetime of sickness. Fear of contamination led to discrimination. And it wasn't just the Japanese that suffered. Thousands of Koreans had been forced to Hiroshima to help the war effort, like the family of Jin Ho Kim.
There were rumours that people exposed to radiation couldn't get married or couldn't have children. My parents had this rule that they absolutely couldn't talk about the fact that they had been exposed to the bomb.
Atomic bomb survivors, known as hibakisha, dream of a world without nuclear weapons. Last year, the network won the Nobel Peace Prize. Satoshi Tanaka was there.
We have two major demands: to eliminate nuclear weapons, which are the root of all evil for humanity, and to prevent any more victims of nuclear weapons.
Despite the recognition, there is pessimism in the movement amid ongoing geopolitical tensions.
How can we influence, even by a millimeter, a handful of leaders who hold the nuclear buttons? These are the very people who turn a blind eye to the Nobel Peace Prize.
Here's Kunihiko Ida again.
Most people have no idea about the power of the atomic bomb, and modern nuclear weapons are hundreds of times more powerful than that one.
Lessons from the past. This is James Oten in Hiroshima, reporting for AM.
That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast.
If this week's reports are correct, Benjamin Netanyahu wants to expand the war in Gaza. So what can the world do to stop that? Well, France, Canada and the UK had already been trying to pressure Israel by announcing plans to recognise a Palestinian state, a move Australia could take too. Today, Guy Ziff, an associate professor at American University, on what that means and whether it could help. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.